This is AM with Sabra Lane.
The Citizenship 7, a High Court hearing begins to decide the fate of seven politicians with dual citizenship. It's a case that could trigger a by-election for the Deputy PM Barnaby Joyce, and voters in his seat of New England know it.
We don't have phone service, mobile phone service, so to me that's a big thing.
My biggest issue is water, the price we've got to pay for it.
Cyber attacks on the rise. We'll tell you about the latest targets and concerns about China's influence within our universities. Good morning and welcome to AM. Computers are part of every facet of our lives, from the cars and smartphones we use to laptops and tablets at work and home, and even life-saving equipment in hospitals. And never before have there been so many threats, be it malicious emails or ransomware and even cyber attacks against government and businesses. During the past financial year, there have been 47,000 cyber incidents in Australia, up 15% on the previous year. And despite all the warnings about online scams and frauds, they're up too by 22%. Their findings contained in this year's Australian Cybersecurity Threat Report. The Minister assisting the Prime Minister for Cybersecurity, Dan Tehan, joined me earlier. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be with you, Sabra.
They're pretty big increases. How worried are you that these crimes are going up exponentially each year?
Yeah, look, we are concerned, and that's why we release the threat report each year, because we want to be fully transparent about what is occurring. But the key message is that all of us have a role to play when it comes to keeping us safe online, whether that be government, whether that be business, or whether that be mums and dads or community organisations. And it's Stay Smart Online Week this week, and that's why we've coincided the release of the threat report with Stay Smart Online Week, because there are simple steps that people can take. Be careful about what personal information you put online. Be careful about what you click on, emails, attachments. If they're suspicious, don't click on them. Back up your data. Make sure that you patch. Make sure that you're updating the latest applications, and ensure that you've got a safe password. Password one doesn't cut it.
All right. You've got that plug in. Onto the rest of the stuff.
Yep.
The cost to companies in money and time is huge. Some businesses, have they gone bust because of it? Have patients died because equipment's not worked properly?
What we've seen, for instance, when there was the major global ransomware attack, was that this impacted the national health system in the UK. It meant that in some instances they had to turn patients away. So it can have real life impacts. There will be an example in my speech today that I will give of a business where ransomware cost that company $500,000 US. And that's why we're saying everyone has a part to play, government, business, and the community.
You're also revealing that in the report that a defence contractor was infiltrated and a large amount of data was stolen. Was a government behind this attack?
What we say, and this is part of our transparency, is that there was impact on a business which was contracting in the national security space. We don't know and we cannot confirm exactly who the actor was. But I can say this, Sabra, cyber espionage is alive and well, and it's something that we need to be conscious about, and it's why the government is taking the actions it is to do everything we can to keep the government safe and protect government systems.
In the past year, the intelligence agency, the Australian Signals Directorate, responded to 671 cases of cyber attack or threat. How many of those cases were state-based attacks? Are you able to say?
We don't go into that level of detail, but I'll go back to the point I just made. Cyber espionage is alive and well. There are state actors out there who are using malicious activity to try and get access to state secrets or other types of information. We're aware of that, we're cognizant of it, and we're doing everything we can to make sure that we're protecting our systems.
During the past year, the new Information Warfare Division within Defence was established. Is it operational? Is it disrupting attacks? And is it in the position now where it is actually launching offensive operations?
So we set up the Information Warfare Division on 1 July this year, and it has a specific cyber unit as part of that. Now, obviously, I don't go and I won't go into the operational details of what it's doing, but needless to say, it's been set up because there is a real need there to protect our ICT systems when it comes to land. So whether, you know, how our tanks operate, when it comes to sea, when it comes to, you know, our ships and the ICT infrastructure around those. So this is incredibly important, and also obviously when it comes to air.
Is it fully operational?
Cyberspace is absolutely a crucial component now of what we do when it comes to our military. Now, the government has said that we're using our offensive cyber capability when it comes to target terrorists in the Middle East. In terms of a government, we have been the most forward-leaning when it comes to saying what capabilities we've got, but I won't go into the operational aspects of that.
The ADF is also looking to establish a cyber reserve. When and who will Defence want as recruits?
What we'll be looking to is those people in industry who have the requisite skills. So we know, for instance, when it comes to telecommunications, when it comes to our banking sectors, that they have cyber people embedded who have very, very good skills who we could call on in times of national emergency. And it would operate how our normal Army Reserve works, but we might look at, okay, when it comes to recruitment and the testing that you have to do, we might look to see, okay, are your strengths more in the IT area rather than when it comes to the physical fitness side?
Right. The Attorney General's releasing draft legislation today which would give the government power to direct critical infrastructure projects and companies to defend against cyber attacks. Are there cases that you can think of recently where those powers could have been used?
There's not cases that I can think of where they would have been used recently. But into the future, there potentially could be cases, and that's why we want to bring this legislation in. We want to make sure that companies understand the national security requirements on them to ensure that this critical infrastructure is kept safe, because when it comes to cyber incidents, and we've seen this internationally, for instance, a hit on a power grid can have catastrophic implications for that country. And unfortunately, we've seen state actors use that in the past. So we want to make sure that here in Australia, we're doing everything we can to keep our critical infrastructure safe.
All right. Dan Tehan, thank you very much for joining AM this morning.
Pleasure, Sabra.
The Minister assisting the Prime Minister for Cybersecurity, Dan Tehan. Seven federal politicians will face the High Court in hearings that begin today. The most high-profile among them is the Deputy Prime Minister, Barnaby Joyce. He's the only lower house MP to be embroiled in the citizenship crisis. If Mr. Joyce is ruled ineligible because of his Kiwi heritage, he's expecting to face voters in a by-election. It's a crucial electorate because the government only holds a one-seat majority in the lower house. Reporter Anna Henderson travelled to New England and filed this report.
In the main street of Tamworth, it's not hard to find people wanting to talk about their political wish list. Marjorie Thomas lives in the town of Dungowan, just 25 kilometres outside the regional centre of Tamworth. But for her, staying connected is a struggle.
We don't have phone service, mobile phone service. So to me, that's a big thing for our area. It's the tower's supposed to be coming.
Cole Cooper from Woolerman, southeast of Tamworth, says recent controversy over water ownership has him riled up.
My biggest issue is water, all the water licences and things like that, and the price we've got to pay for it.
Both live in the Deputy Prime Minister's seat of New England, and like Christine Wall from South Tamworth, they're fans of the Deputy Prime Minister.
Oh, yes, I'm all behind Barnaby. Yes, I think he's a great fellow. Yes, and he does a lot for the area.
It's that appeal that Barnaby Joyce will be banking on if the High Court decides he breached the Constitution and he goes to a by-election. While he doesn't want to preempt the court's ruling, New South Wales Nationals Chairman Bede Burke says he's hoping for a swift resolution.
It has a huge impact, but it's really important that we allow the processes to continue, and we just have to wait until the High Court makes a determination later, but hopefully sooner rather than later.
ABC election analyst Anthony Green says New England is now a safe national seat again. And even though Labor, the Greens and One Nation might run, they won't pose a genuine threat.
In my view, Tonya Wynn is the only person who could beat Barnaby Joyce. The Labor Party just doesn't win seats like New England.
The former member, Mr. Windsor, has joined the High Court action against his successor, but isn't revealing whether he wants to be a candidate if a by-election was called. Mr. Windsor's legal team includes controversial former Solicitor General Justin Gleeson, but he's sounding less likely to take a fresh tilt at the seat.
The issues are still there, and irrespective of whether there is a by-election, no by-election, a recount, no recount, or some other thing that the High Court may decide, I'm going to be involved in these issues.
Back on Tamworth's Peel Street, the federal government's recent campaigns on mining and utility bills are cutting through.
Well, I think I'd make the biggest decision would be on the coal mines and the gas mine.
Electricity, that's a big one for us. We're always trying to find a better deal.
The High Court is scheduled to sit for 3 days.
Anna Henderson. The Federal Education Minister, Simon Birmingham, says Australian universities need to be ever vigilant about their academic integrity and independence. His comments come amid increasing concerns about China's influence within the nation's higher education sector. Stephanie Boris has more.
The Education Minister, Simon Birmingham, says debate in the classroom is a key part of Australian education.
Every student should be challenged when they're at university. They should have their thinking challenged, and they should find it a challenging experience.
Amid concerns about China's influence in universities, he's urging the sector not to let its guard down.
Universities need to be as ever vigilant today as they have been through their history in terms of ensuring their integrity, their high standing, their delivery of quality education. And I'm confident that they are doing that, that they are challenging the students who come to them, whatever the background of those students.
His comments follow rare public remarks from the Department of Foreign Affairs Secretary Frances Adamson about China's influence in Australia. During a speech over the weekend, she told the university sector to remain secure and resilient against foreign interference. Alex Joski is studying China's influence in Australia at the Australian National University. He was born here, but his mother is Chinese, and he believes universities need to work on better integration programs to help international students understand our way of life.
Universities need to try to find a way to get Chinese students to mix in better, but it's quite difficult. But there are definite programs that you could implement. You could implement buddy programs, for example, just to give them one Australian friend when they arrive at the university.
Education Minister Simon Birmingham agrees more can be done.
That is something for us all to focus on, universities, governments, policymakers, employers and others, to make sure that whether it's the accommodation settings for international students or whether it is the learning environments for them.
After her speech, Frances Adamson was asked about China's One Belt, One Road initiative, an ambitious plan to build a vast network of new trade routes across the globe. Ms. Adamson sounded caution, saying Australia is looking at the financing and governance arrangements. Nick Bisley is a board member of China Matters, a think tank examining China's rise and the impact on Australia. He says the Secretary's comments showed the government doesn't have a clear way forward on how to handle Chinese ambitions.
It seems to be a bit like the deer in the headlights, or a bit muddled as to quite where to go on this one. And I think that's partly because we don't quite know where Belt and Road is going to finish.
The Australia-China Business Council National CEO, Helen Suvchuk, is urging the government to keep an open mind.
National security concerns are, of course, important. However, the Belt and Road Initiative does offer great economic commercial opportunities for Australian businesses.
Labor has already said it will consider working with China, examining infrastructure projects on a case-by-case basis.
Stephanie Boris reporting. The West Australian National Party says the Prime Minister must find the political courage needed to give WA a fair share of the GST. During the past year, Malcolm Turnbull's been promising the West he would introduce a percentage floor under which no state's GST share could fall. But yesterday's Treasurer, Scott Morrison, backed away from the idea. The WA Nationals leader, Mia Davey, says any solution will mean taking money from other states, and she's worried the federal government doesn't have the political will to do it. From Perth, Eliza Borello reports.
The WA Nationals leader, Mia Davey, says she's pleased the Productivity Commission's draft GST report vouches for her state's sanity.
It confirmed that all West Australians weren't mad, they weren't whingers, that we knew that our system was not delivering for Western Australians.
The report, released yesterday, outlined several measures which would boost WA's low GST share. But it also criticises the Turnbull government's concept of a GST floor, below which no state's share could fall, saying it's not a long-term solution. The Federal Treasurer, Scott Morrison, is now backing away from the idea, saying the government's policy is in transition. Mia Davies wants it defined and acted on quickly.
Whatever solution gets put on the table will require political bravery. At some point in time, our West Australian representatives, the Prime Minister and the Treasurer, will need to stand up and make a decision that will disadvantage some states and advantage others.
Ben Morton is a member of the WA Liberals' large contingent of federal MPs. He says his party has been working solidly on the issue and the process shouldn't be rushed.
The process we have in place is a good process. It's a process that's considered and it's showing fruit. Making this change and making this change stick is going to be really important to delivering the change that we need in WA.
Are you confident, though, that we've got a Treasurer that is willing to take tough decisions that involve taking money away from states other than Western Australia?
I know Scott Morrison very well. I've worked with him for over a decade. He will do what is right. He knows that the GST distribution is not working the way it should. We want a fix to the GST distribution, not just for WA, but for one that delivers productivity and economic growth for the entire nation.
As for abandoning the idea of a GST floor, Ben Morton says the focus should be on prevention rather than short-term cure.
The issue of a floor, a commitment to a floor, is where the formula isn't working. What the Productivity Commission is saying is we can make the formula work, we can make it do what it needs to do to boost productivity and grow our economy, and therefore the floor is not required.
The Productivity Commission's final report isn't due until January.
Eliza Borello reporting. This is AM and it's 16 past 8. Scandals, alleged misconduct and poor financial advice have cost major banks and insurance companies almost $500 million in payouts and compensation during the past 2 years, according to research compiled by Industry Super Australia. The lobby group representing union-backed super funds has jumped on the rising payouts bill. It's fighting federal government moves to shake up the composition of superannuation fund boards to ensure at least a third of trustees are independent. The governance stoush takes centre stage at a Senate hearing later this morning. Industry Super Australia's head of public affairs, Matt Linden, spoke with senior business correspondent Peter Ryan.
Well, look, we're presenting evidence today of compensation, refunds, remediation and consumer losses of $500 million since 2015 when this governance bill was last before the parliament. There's around $200 million of money-for-nothing scandals. This is the banks and their wealth management arms charging advice fees when they're not actually providing any services. It includes inappropriate insurance or denial of legitimate claims. It includes not applying fee waivers as promised, breaching responsible lending laws, and it even includes a failure in the case of the Commonwealth Bank to pay its own employees their correct super entitlements.
And these are the payouts that we know about. Have you calculated things like private settlements, contributions to financial literacy or community programs?
These are only the things which have been made public and out in the public domain and where there's admitted fault. So it doesn't include those things, and some of those scandals which we've seen on the front pages this year are around money laundering. This is only compensation, refunds, remediation of consumer losses.
Today's hearings are a big opportunity to send the message that industry super funds have been free of scandals. Even so, surely having more independent directors is a good thing in terms of governance.
Well, look, industry super funds will appoint independent directors where there's a need to do so on the basis of each fund's individual circumstances. But we certainly do not accept the proposition that mandating a particular quota of independent directors and those drawn from the finance sector is a sensible way to improve the outcomes for industry super fund members.
And that's a point you'll be making in evidence to the Senate hearing today, that independent directors do come from that banking and insurance background, so they're not necessarily independent.
These independent directors have sat on the boards of these major banks whilst all of these scandals have been occurring. We don't see this as at all a sensible way in which to improve the outcomes for members of industry super funds and other not-for-profit funds.
The Financial Services Minister, Kelly O'Dwyer, is the latest minister to try to get this through. Arthur Sinodinos and Josh Frydenberg tried and failed. But do you have the support to be able to block these bills next time around?
Well, look, we're very confident that within the Parliament and certainly within the Senate, the crossbench understand that industry super funds and other not-for-profit funds with these equal representation boards have significantly outperformed those in the retail sector, on average by 2% per annum. When I've talked to those crossbenchers, they've not had people walking in their doors complaining about the returns that they're getting from industry super funds and other not-for-profit funds. They have, however, had dozens come through their doors who've been ripped off through these scandals perpetrated by the banks and their wealth management arms.
Industry Super Australia's Matt Linden speaking there with Peter Ryan, and the Financial Services Minister Kelly O'Dwyer says the proposed changes are in the best interest of members, and she rejects claims the government is on an ideological union-busting mission. You might think living life on the land would lead to a healthier lifestyle, but people in rural and remote areas have some of the worst death rates from heart disease, according to research from the Heart Foundation. It's mapped the data showing deaths from heart disease are 60% higher in rural and remote areas than for people living in the cities. David Cody has more.
The Heart Foundation map shows dark red splashed over vast parts of Australia. That's where death rates from heart disease are highest. It's only when you zoom in on the cities you can pick out patches of orange and yellow. Adjunct Professor John Kelly is the Chief Executive of the Heart Foundation of Australia.
It tells us where you live matters as much as how you live. Heart disease deaths are 50% higher in disadvantaged rural and remote areas. And obviously for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, deaths from heart disease are 70% higher than in non-Indigenous Australians.
The Queensland outback, including the regional centres of Mount Isa, Longreach and Charleville, is ranked worst for deaths from chronic heart disease. Almost 122 people die of the disease for each 100,000 people. At a state level, the highest proportion of obese residents are in Tasmania and Queensland. Residents most likely to smoke are in the Northern Territory and Tasmania.
It really does come down to inequality. The better health outcomes in advantaged communities are definitely linked to other factors such as good education, reliable, secure employment, safe, affordable housing, accessible transport, affordable, healthy food, and appropriate health services and social support.
John Kelly's calling for heart health check programs to be funded in remote areas, plus education programs so everyone knows how to identify a heart attack. Dr. Ewan McPhee is the president of the Rural Doctors Association of Australia. He says remote Australians need better access to fresh and affordable food.
Fresh fruit and veggies cost an arm and a leg. You know, the sort of stuff that people take for granted living in provincial and city centres just doesn't happen in the bush.
He says access to a doctor is also essential, and he's calling for greater Medicare rebates for bush GPs and a focus on doctor training.
We know that if we select people who've got no rural interest at all, that they're never going to go outside the confines of a major city. So we need to basically be selecting the right people to do the job.
Rural Doctors Association's Dr. Ewan McPhee ending David Cody's report. And if you're interested in looking for your city, search Heart Foundation and Maps in your search engine. The Food Health Star rating system is supposed to make it easier for consumers to buy healthy products, but there's concern some companies are using it to make their goods look healthier than they are due to the so-called as prepared rule. For example, Milo scores 4.5 stars out of 5, which has prompted a review into the scheme. But an advisor to the program's accused the food industry of intentionally prolonging that review. Lexi Metherill explains.
The review of the controversial rule began in May this year. It doesn't finish until the second quarter of 2019. Public health lawyer Alexandra Jones from the George Institute for Global Health says the issue could be resolved if it weren't for industry insisting on a lengthy consultation process.
It's a well-known tactic of the food industry to ask for more evidence and consultation as a way of delaying meaningful public health policy.
Alexandra Jones sits on the Health Star Rating Technical Advisory Group. She says the so-called as prepared rule is a loophole in the Health Star rating scheme. It allows companies to label products with stars based on how they're intended to be prepared, rather than on their standalone nutritional value.
So in the case of Milo, Nestle say that that's 3 teaspoons of the chocolate powder with 200 mils of skim milk. What we know is that that's not how many people eat Milo. Only 3% of milk sales are from skim milk. Most people drink full cream.
The sugary chocolate powder gets 4.5 out of 5 stars under the Health Star rating scheme. Alexandra Jones says if it was assessed on its own merits, it would only get 1.5 stars. And she says that's undermining public confidence in the Health Star rating system.
We really just need a blanket rule that every product has to display Health Stars based on what's in the packet.
Nestle says it welcomes the as-prepared rule review and it doesn't have a view on whether it should change. Its industry body is more forthright and argues against a change. Geoffrey Annison is the Deputy Chief Executive of the Australian Food and Grocery Council.
The important thing is that the Milo is intended to be consumed with the skim milk. And the company is following the directions of the Food Standards Australia New Zealand and the regulations that require that nutrition labelling reflects the product as intended to be consumed.
Alexandra Jones.
I think that that makes sense when you're talking about the nutrient information panel that appears on the back of the pack. The problem is that when you transfer this to a single symbol on the front of the packet, there's no longer any intuitive link to how the Health Star relates to what's sold in the pack.
The Food and Grocery Council says the timeline for the review of the as-prepared rule was agreed to by the Health Star Rating Committee that includes public health representatives. But Alexandra Jones says there's scope for a decision to be made sooner.
We think resolving the matter now would be a great chance to show and reassure consumers that Health Stars is about working for them, not just food companies.
Public health lawyer Alexandra Jones from the George Institute for Global Health, ending Lexi Metherill's report. The fallout is spreading from the Defence Department's failure to tackle chemical contamination from the use of firefighting foam on its bases. Defence has admitted it'll cost taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars to clean up the problem, and hundreds of people are seeking compensation. As Nancy Notson reports, a mango farmer near Katherine in the Northern Territory is one of them.
Paddy Fordham's small mango farm near Katherine has been his livelihood for the past 20 years. Now tests show his water supply is contaminated with potentially toxic chemicals once used in firefighting foam at the nearby Tyndall RAAF base. So he spoke to a Defence Department representative.
I asked him about the mangoes and he said, well, that's okay, as long as you don't eat too many of them. And I said, hang on, I do this for a living. And he said, well, you can go online and fill in a compensation claim if you like.
Paddy Fordham thought the tests done by Defence showed the levels of PFAS chemicals in his water supply were up to 0.4 micrograms a litre, about 6 times above the accepted limit for drinking water.
He didn't seem to think it was a problem. Like he even said 0.4 and 0.3, he said that's not dangerous.
But it wasn't until he went through the paperwork with the ABC that he realised his levels were much higher. The document shows his tank, which supplies his house, has a PFAS level of 4.6 micrograms a litre, nearly 66 times above the deemed safe limit for drinking water. The bore which irrigates his mangoes is 60 times over.
Of course I'm worried because it was only 0.4, 0.3 coming out of the tap and 0.4 out of the bore.
While there are guidelines for safe levels of PFAS chemicals in water supplies, there aren't for food. Defence has taken samples of Paddy Fordham's soil and mango trees, but he hasn't been given the results. He has heard from the NT Department of Primary Industry and Resources. In an email, it's told him,
it is recommended that people should not source all of their dietary requirements from impacted areas to limit the potential for elevated accumulation.
It also says,
as fruit enters the market, the potential for a subsequent individual to be exposed to levels exceeding the recommended limit becomes negligible, which is why controls have not been required.
Just a few minutes away from Paddy Fordham's mango farm, Yonder Beer says Defence has also been testing at his property, taking blood samples from his cows and goats.
They use a needle in it and have the blood.
Did they say why they were doing it?
No. So far I know I'm the only one where they have done it.
While Defence is testing some animals for PFAS chemicals, there's growing pressure for residents to be offered blood tests too. As for mango farmer Paddy Fordham, he's now hired a lawyer and is asking the Defence Department for compensation.
Nancy Notson reporting, and the ABC has contacted the Department of Defence for a comment. It's not responded. Checking finance now, and Wall Street has closed slightly weaker. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down by a sixth of 1%. Oil is higher at $49.57 a barrel, and the Australian dollar is steady this morning. It's currently trading at around 77.54 US cents. That is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane. It's 8:30.